All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. You can email us, as always, at radio@thefederalist.com. Today, we're talking about a subject that has fascinated, I know, millions of Americans over the last couple of years, a story that has become something at the center of our political debate, our Me Too debate, and a number of conspiracy theories, and perhaps real theories in life. And that's the death of Jeffrey Epstein. Today, we have joining us today, Alana Goodman, who is senior investigative reporter at the Washington Free Beacon. We also have Daniel Halper, who is the former best-selling author of Clinton Inc. and previously was at the New York Post and the Weekly Standard. You can follow them both respectively at Alana Goodman and at Daniel Halper on Twitter. Their new book is A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein. Thanks so much for joining us today, Alana and Daniel.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I have a number of questions for you, but first I just want to establish a certain perspective on what would drive you both to collaborate on writing a book about a topic that is certain to attract a ton of controversy and a lot of pressure when it comes to getting things right. Alana and Daniel, if you want to just address that, at what point did you decide we want to collaborate and do work on this project, even though we know the pressure that's going to be involved?
It's one of the biggest crime stories in America, and we felt that there were so many unanswered questions about this. And we were talking to Keith Urban, who is our agent on this book, about the possibility of doing this. And we both found it to be a topic that was really interesting. We wanted to look into how could this have happened. How could he have died while he was in federal custody? How was he able to get away with his crimes for so long? His relationships with all of these powerful political figures. It was just kind of a story that had everything. It was like this intersection of crime and popular culture and politics. And we wanted to move the ball forward as much as we could in terms of answering these questions. But I'll let Dan respond as well to that.
Well, I've always had a lot of respect for Alana, and she's a great reporter. So working together was a joy, and it was very easy and interesting. So that part of the story came together. But as Alana said, the story's compelling. I mean, it's like a deep mystery, and I think it also exposes something like about our society. So there's, you know, as soon as Jeffrey Epstein died, there was widespread skepticism that it was suicide, but which was the official ruling, of course, but that changed, right? So it became, it was like 30% of the population thought that it was a murder. And then within a couple of months, it was like over 50%. And now I don't think there's been polling on it in like 6 months, but I'm sure it's grown even more. And I think what we're seeing is something that tells us about who we are and how we operate and sort of how much we can trust our elites and our government. And the fact that a lot of these questions still haven't been answered by the government has left voids, and that has allowed conspiracy theories and regular theories to flourish. And it's by studying it, I think there's a lot of different angles. There is the mystery, there is his life, and there, of course, is who we are that allowed this to happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to start with the end, because I think that's the element there that you bring up, Daniel, that really, for even the non-conspiracy theory-minded, among those I know personally, the death was one that really changed their minds in lots of ways. As you were looking into this and studying it, what were some of the things that popped out to you, either in interviews with former prison guards or people related to this case, that answered questions or just raised more for you in a way that was really tangible? What were some of the wow moments for each of you? And Alana, why don't you go first?
Yeah, well, I think I first say that both Dan and I were, I think you could say, very skeptical of the skepticism about the suicide theory at the beginning when we set out to look at this book. And I guess as we went along and as we reported it, we talked to prison guards who worked at the Metropolitan Correctional Center where Epstein died, who said it would have been extremely difficult for him to kill himself in this way without outside help. We talked to one of Epstein's lawyers, David Schoen, who described how Epstein was enthusiastically planning his legal defense strategy in the hours before he died, and was in good spirits at that time. And we talked to Epstein's brother, Mark, who said that he has had a hard time getting information about this from authorities, and who was able to obtain a picture of the noose that Epstein allegedly used to commit suicide. And he was questioning why there was no cut marks on it, since one of the guards at MCC said he cut down Epstein from the noose. When you look at the photograph, the edges of the noose appear to be hemmed. So there were a lot of reasons to say that this is not a simple case and foul play still can't be dismissed.
Dan, if you want to answer the same question, what was a wow moment for you as you were going through and interviewing everybody?
Yeah, I agree, obviously, with what Alana said. I mean, you sort of have your mindset on how something might have taken place. And obviously, as you learn more information, anybody with somewhat of an open mind might change their view. I think that Jeffrey Epstein, what I was stunned to learn is just that he was a total con man. And you have this sense that he's like a professional guy who's kind of perverted. But in fact, everything about him was just kind of a fraud. And I thought that was like a really interesting revelation. And it also changed the way I thought about the end of his life. So if everything about him is a fraud and he, as Alana said, she talked to the lawyer extensively who was going to represent him. And he was optimistic about his case. I mean, they understood ultimately that he was Jeffrey Epstein and public perception was against him, but actually he was optimistic about his case and thought that he could legally win this argument and live out of prison and be set free. And Jeffrey Epstein had escaped every other time people had closed in on him. He had done well for himself every single time. And so the idea that all of a sudden he gives up and he decides, well, my life is over, I might as well take it, it just didn't quite conform with his personality.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about the reasons for his optimism, even up until his death. Why did he think, just given the crush of media coverage for this case, the way that people definitely perceived him at the time as being, someone who was, at least at the a scumbag or a con man, if not perhaps guilty of specific crimes that people didn't know about yet. Why did Epstein have project optimism? And do you believe it was honest and true as opposed to being just a put on?
I mean, honest or true to him, yes. I think he believed his own BS, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, I think he never believed he did anything wrong, ever. He thought that he acted, morally and correct. At least that was how he projected to other people. And he never once signaled any sort of remorse. But also legally, he had pled guilty to similar crimes that he was being charged with. And weirdly, when the feds brought the charges against him, they were referring to the time period which he had already pled guilty to. So they were going to use double jeopardy type defense. They had a legal strategy, which I don't know. I mean, it might seem crazy because everybody assumes that he is guilty, and I assume he's guilty too. But the question is not, was he guilty? Did he believe that he would be out of prison? And I think it's rather convincing, at least so.
Yeah. I would just add to that also, I think his lawyers were very confident as well. They had not only the agreement that he had reached from his prior arrest, as a non-prosecution agreement, but also they thought that that was probably their best shot. But even without that, they would have looked at double jeopardy issues, as Dan mentioned, and also potentially interstate travel issues. You know, could the state prove that this, you know, that there was interstate travel here? And so I think that they were very confident. And I would also mention Jeffrey Epstein had just so much money at his disposal. I mean, he could hire, and he did, he hired a fantastic legal team. He could just spend a limitless amount of money on this case. And I think that he was confident that he'd be able to buy his way out of it, or at least be able to buy his way to, you know, a lesser sentence.
You know, that's something that I think a lot of people assume when they see rich people go into these situations, that they're able to find their ways out of them. I wonder, in your perspective on the final days of Epstein, if you had any indications, or you talked to anybody who did give you an indication that he was suicidal, that he was considering suicide, especially considering that, you know, there was the reported attempt that was foiled. It seemed like he was close to that anyway. Do you have any perspective on that?
I would not say that there was anybody that we talked to who was, you know, said that they saw any indications prior to this that he was suicidal. There were certainly some people who we spoke to who said, I think that he killed himself because he might have been upset about facing so potentially life in prison, or maybe because of the mental strain of the whole situation. But no, I mean, and from everyone who we spoke to, there was no one who said that they saw prior indications of him appearing to be suicidal. I mean, in fact, the opposite. His lawyer and friend for several years, David Schoen, said that he had met with him a few days before his death, and Epstein appeared to be in good spirits. He looked healthy. He was fired up about fighting this case. By all means, nobody who was around him saw this coming.
As for him being on suicide watch, his lawyers dismissed that and said that it was a prank gone awry. They didn't actually think that he was suicidal then either. And that's obviously, they're basing that off of their conversations with him. So either that's part of the con to think people, or it really didn't happen and he really wasn't suicidal, and that it was sort of a misunderstanding. Obviously, we're not sure, mm-hmm. But we're basing this off of the interviews and the best information available.
When you were talking to all these various people, did you achieve some greater clarity on the behavior of the officers and the cameras that evening? I think that's one of the aspects of this that made people far more suspicious. Why, given the prominence of this, were the surveillance cameras not working in a way that would ensure that people could have a little bit more confidence about what happened?
Yeah, that was something that actually really shocked the prison guards who I spoke to, who had worked at MCC and had said, for a high-profile inmate like that, especially if he had some sort of incident, which the prison said was a suicide attempt previously, a few weeks before. Obviously, Epstein, his lawyers had denied that. But the prison guard said, when you have somebody who's so high profile, they could not imagine the camera being broken for longer than a few minutes before somebody came in and fixed it, because they said you would want to monitor somebody like that. He's a high value inmate, and there's concerns not just about, you know, him not even looking at whether concerns about him hurting himself, also other inmates. I mean, he's someone who's in there for a sex crime involving children. And that makes somebody a serious target, not to mention the fact that he was also very, very wealthy and all over the media. And so that would put a target on his back as well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you had something to add to that, Daniel, but just also thinking through this, I think people don't necessarily understand the logistics of the way that facilities like this work. What, in terms of what you found, was out of protocol, was something that was clearly kind of either broken, ignored, or irresponsible behavior on the part of the guards?
Well, he shouldn't have been alone to begin with, right? If he Yes. was coming off of suicide watch, he shouldn't have been alone. Or if he was left alone, he should have been monitored the whole time. So that's sort of the big one. But as you suggested, all the mysteriously, every single camera that might have captured what happened that night, either it was broken or its footage disappeared. In order to believe that it's like a suicide, you can believe that he paid people off and he was in on it. That he had other people in on it, so he didn't act alone. Or you have to believe that it's just a strange coincidence that sort of of things that happened that lead to the mystery, that sort of make this mysterious. To me, that's not really like such a believable theory, right? Just because so many things went wrong that night. This is a prison that does hold, or, you know, high level people, like very, you know, hardened criminals like El Chapo, mafiosos. It also holds like Michael Avenatti, so very, very high profile people as well. It might be a disgusting place and might be gross, but the bad things happen in prison, as we well know, but you have to, like, it has to be a sort of a level of incompetence that we can't really understand if all these things just happened by coincidence. And at the same time, Jeffrey Epstein decided he took his life. Oh, and by the way, the physical evidence on him and his broken bones are more consistent with a strangulation than a suicide by hanging. So it is kind of like a test of what your beliefs are and how strongly you want to believe, you know, the government or the authorities. Do you want to believe what they say just despite your eyes, or do you want to believe like what you see and what you feel? And the whole Jeffrey Epstein story, in my mind, is sort of that test. Like, where do you come down on how you see the government, how honest they are with you, how truthful they've been, or, you know, and to me, that's part of the element of the story that's so fascinating.
You know, I honestly am always one of those people who is a skeptic of conspiracy theories. There are very few conspiracy theories that I believe in. Though I'm sure everybody has one or two. Whenever anybody has been pushing this on me, I've been a little more skeptical. And one of the elements of that that always crops up, particularly when you're dealing with both policing and jails and all of the elements involved there, is, can this be explained by incompetence as opposed to a conspiracy? And I'm fond of saying that we should always consider the possibility that we're led by idiots. In this case, do you believe, after having gone through all of this research, that it's almost impossible, or it really would be a stretch to say this can all be explained by a bunch of people being idiots and bad at their jobs?
So we kind of differ on this. My inclination is more towards murder, and Alana's is more towards suicide. Although I'll let her speak for herself, but we wrote the book so that people can sort of make up their own minds, right? Like, we're not here to hammer home exactly what conspiracy theories we may believe in. We just actually present the facts, and it's like, well, here's what happened, here's what's interesting, and we let sort of people decide and go through their own process and come up with their own conclusions. I think readers tend to be pretty smart, and they're able to do so for themselves.
Alana, what do you think?
Yeah, I would say the short answer is that I still don't know, but I do know that based on what we found, I don't think that foul play can be dismissed outright. I think that the onus is also on the federal government, who should be, this was a super high profile guy. I mean, this was one of the biggest crime stories in America, when, this major, major sex trafficking operation that he's accused of running. We need to know why he was able to evade justice. And I think that we need the more transparency from the Department of Justice. I think that we need more transparency from the New York Medical Examiner's Office. I think that they should release full video evidence to the extent that that they still have it. I know a lot of it has disappeared, obviously, or was not recorded in the first place, but release any video evidence that they have and full medical evidence so that we can have a complete accounting of what happened that night.
So I want to shift back, now that we've talked a little bit about the death situation, to everything else that you looked at around the Epstein case and the many relationships that he had. And I want to ask you, first off, as you were doing this research and reporting, how much attention were you paying to the other projects that were being done on this story? I myself have listened to two different podcasts, running podcasts about this story that were researched over, a lengthy amount of time. There's obviously a Netflix documentary that is out now, which is being criticized as a real whitewash of a lot of the other people who were involved in this. What was your perception of the way that you were reporting out this story as it relates to the different friendships and connections that Epstein became known to have had?
Look, I don't want to criticize anybody else's work. I think a lot of it's interesting. I haven't listened to every single podcast, and I did watch the Netflix thing. I think one of the things that we do that the others don't is we focus on his death, the last few hours. Mm-hmm. And we focus sort of on who he was, on him being like a con man. I think that's a big theme throughout our book, and how he conned his way into the upper echelons of media, of academia, of finance, of the political world, and how he was able to convince people of something that they wanted him to be, that he was kind of convinced people and con his way into being in these higher esteemed groups of people. So I think ours as a project isn't as focused on some of the victim stories, mm-hmm. though I obviously think that's important. I think other people have covered a lot of that ground rather convincingly. Ours is more of just like, who is Epstein? Why was he able to get away with these crimes? And what happened at the end of his life?
Give me, Alana, your perspective on what made Epstein so good at manipulating people. This is the thing that crops up again and again in interview after interview, book after book, piece after piece about him, that he just has this uncanny ability to manipulate people. Some people in the conspiracy-minded sense assume that means, oh, maybe he has blackmail or information on them. Maybe he's able to do so in ways that are untoward. In other cases, it seems more like he just had some kind of smoldering charisma or charm that just overwhelmed any questions about the veracity of who he was and pushed any questions aside. Why do you think he was good at this?
Yeah, that's actually interesting, because there were certain people who we talked to who said, you know, this is he, I've known Epstein for a long time and I still like the guy. I mean, he really did charm a lot of his friends, and some of them still say, you know, he, even at the end, that they still really liked him. Then there were other people who said they never found him to be charming. They found him to be kind of this obnoxious bore. But I think that what he had was this kind of supreme confidence. And he was able to kind of go and tell people what they wanted to hear. I talked to Stephen Hoffenberg, who was one of Epstein's bosses when he was just starting out in the financial world. And Hoffenberg also spent time in prison for a Ponzi scheme that he ran. And he said the thing that Epstein could do was he just could sense your weaknesses and was able to tell you exactly what you wanted to hear in that specific circumstance. And Hoffenberg called this just a gift. And of course, this is coming from somebody who himself was convicted of fraud. So, probably a high compliment, I guess, in that regard. I know Epstein definitely, he created this kind of air of mystery around him as well. He wanted to give people the impression that he knew a lot of wealthy people. He knew a lot of famous people. He knew a lot of important world leaders. And this was even kind of early on in his career before he really got going. So yeah, I think that was part of his allure and part of his, so-called charm.
And he was also very rich, and he gave off the impression that he was even richer than he was. And let's not kid ourselves. A lot of people suck up to people with money. I mean, we know this, we see it. And he experienced it and played into it and played up his wealth and pretended that he was richer. And he pretended to throw away around money in ways that were beneficial to him. And a lot of course, now nobody wants to be associated with him. So you have I never really liked Jeffrey Epstein, but in fact, he was invited to a lot of academic conferences where he was around people who had never dreamed of being around so much money. And they see him and they see, well, you know, they sort of magically think that he'll be able to fund their ambitions and their projects and that he'll be generous. And a lot of that stuff never materialized, but I do think it plays into this myth and that he was able to use it to his advantage. And yes, he had that charm, and the charm really helped, as Alana laid out. And I think the money helped just as well.
Dan, the history is rife with examples of people who engage in that kind of behavior, where it's kind of like they have a bit of money, they've got more money than you do, but they don't actually have as much money as you might think they do, or they're not as liquid as you might think they are. He's worth this. Well, yeah, but what does that mean in terms of cash? Is this a situation where you found a lot of examples looking back where people would suck up to him or they would believe that he was going to make some kind of outlandish donation or purchase or help fund various projects. And then they end up just kind of waiting for the check that never comes?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You see that a lot with Harvard and MIT. I mean, I think he gave like $8 million to Harvard, but I think you get a sense of like those people around him, and he, that earned him an office at Harvard, and he was able to sort of parlay that into his own, to his own usefulness. Mm-hmm. But I think people around him thought that they'd get even more. And people around, you can see it. I think in the MIT, they did a report on their own relationship with him, and you can see it in some of those professors' emails. They like, oh, we better be nice to this guy because he's worth a lot of money and he can give us a lot of money. MIT got a lot less than Harvard, but they were under the impression that they were going to get more. I mean, he did things with people's emotions and people's thoughts that to manipulate them. And money is a powerful elixir. And you see that, by the way, and with politicians too. like somebody like Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, he accepts money from Jeffrey Epstein and it earns him an invitation to the White House, and they maintain that friendship. And by the way, he also has an airplane that is useful to Bill Clinton because Bill Clinton, he gives rides to Bill Clinton on it. So yeah, it's funny how like you think that people, maybe they're corruptible, but it would take a lot to corrupt them. But actually people do silly things for not as much money and for, like under the perception that somehow they'll achieve more that way. So I do think it's the wealth in our society allows for people to get away with things that you know, you or I like wouldn't be allowed to do.
Alana, tell me a little bit about the relationship that Bill Clinton had with Jeffrey Epstein and with those who were close to him.
Clinton has certainly tried to downplay the relationship, but we found from our reporting that they were closer than Bill Clinton's camp has kind of acknowledged. In Clinton's case, for example, we found that Epstein had a direct line to President Clinton going back to the 1990s when he was in the White House. So in one case, Clinton was at a party at Carolyn Kennedy's house and Martha's Vineyard, and the Secret Service came up to him and, you know, kind of tapped him on the shoulder and said, "You got a phone call," and it was Jeffrey Epstein. And he stepped out of the party and talked to Epstein for 10 minutes and then came back in. And this was while Clinton was president. So there was, there was a direct line. That's a huge amount of influence to wield, to have a direct line to the president. While he's in the White House. We also found that Clinton actually had a relationship, an affair with Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's on and off girlfriend, who has been accused of helping him procure underage girls. So that, I think, is something that Epstein certainly could have leveraged against Clinton and maybe used to maintain some sort of control in that relationship.
You obviously have reported that, and it's been pushed back and denied by the Clinton camp. How strong is the evidence you believe that you have for that relationship between Clinton and Maxwell?
We're very confident in it. I think their denial is garbage, and I do think that, funny enough, you know, after Epstein died, the story basically went away for Bill Clinton. Like, he was obviously like, who was more convenienced by Epstein's death than the Clintons? And it's kind of shocking that after all this time, the Clintons and all these rich and famous people who are close to Epstein, they never have to answer for the relationship with Epstein. And we're told that, you know, the attorney general announces that there's going to be an investigation into the mysterious death and all these things that went wrong. And where is that investigation? How come almost a year later, we have no indication that the investigation is even ongoing? Mm-hmm. There are people, there's on the record statements about like Ghislaine Maxwell that very clearly state that she was involved in the crimes that Epstein was accused of. Where's law enforcement? How come she is able to operate so freely, and so, you know, that she's not in federal custody right now? It's kind of shocking. So I think just the idea that, well, he denied it and therefore we move on. That's obviously what they want, but it does not convince me at all.
Alana, what would the justification be in terms of opening this up to a higher degree? Would you have to basically go after Maxwell as being part of Epstein's crimes in a provable way, and find witnesses who were able to come forward for things that are, you know, still active, not under statute of limitations, not covered under double jeopardy, obviously, you know, given the previous case, in order to advance this in any way? Is there any interest among any quarter in doing something like that?
We did not see any interest of that during our reporting. And certainly that's something that has been raised by the victims. They say, why you know, why aren't there charges being brought? Why isn't anything happening on this? We just didn't find that there was much of an appetite on that. I mean, I think you also look at Epstein's legal team was very confident about their chances on this. And I think that if you have a situation with someone in a foreign country that you would have to, extradite, you need to be very sure that you're going to win the case, because that is a big issue and could create a lot of, you know, diplomatic sensitivities as well with other countries.
Do we know where Ghislaine is today?
No.
Mm-hmm. What's happening to what the assets that Jeffrey Epstein did own and possess?
So they were left to his brother. In fact, part of the people who were the proponents of the suicide theory, they point to this, that Jeffrey Epstein changed his will 2 days before to move all his assets into a trust in the Virgin Islands that, his brother is the beneficiary of. But his assets, as far as we understand, remain in that trust, and they're being fought over pretty contentiously in court right now that the victims want to share, and perhaps rightfully so, probably rightfully so, to those. I don't understand the legal proceedings. That's my only hesitation. And I think it's going to be fought over the course of a couple of years. It was clearly sent to the Virgin Islands because it would be harder for victims to obtain it that way. Mm-hmm. But that's, as far as we know, the island is, you know, basically unused. I'm not sure if maintenance workers are still there. And there is talk, of course, there's sort of these fantasies that, like, oh, maybe his New York mansion will be turned into a women's museum and things like that. But those seem more fantastical rather than it just everything being sold off and the money being divided.
What does his brother think of that? Does he think that anything is owed to the victims?
Well, we didn't get into that with his brother. But his brother said, he was very he was angry. He was upset that there was no he felt he wasn't getting information from federal authorities, from the New York Medical Examiner's office about what had happened to his brother, and he was trying to look into this and felt that he was just being stonewalled, and he had questions about what happened that he thought he wasn't getting the appropriate answers to.
What was your impression of his brother generally?
I was struck by how much he sounded like Jeffrey Epstein. They're brothers, obviously, but it was kind of a little spooky just, hearing, wow, he sounds so much like him, you know, the voice and hearing that. I think he was upset. What we were told by Dr. Michael Bodden, who was the forensic pathologist who Epstein's brother hired to oversee the autopsy, was that, you know, Mark loves his brother very much. They weren't super close towards the end of his life, but he wants to find out what happened. He wants answers on the death that he didn't think that he has been getting.
This is a story about a manipulative con man who was able to ascend to the heights of society in so many ways, to manage a massive portfolio, to really engage in these the upper crust of the upper crust in his relationships, and is the source of so many different conspiracy theories. Given that level of attention, why do you think it is that law enforcement hasn't announced anything? That some intrepid person hasn't said, hey, we're not going to let the story end this way. We need to really find out what happened. Is it simply that there are too many powerful figures around who still have a stake to keep that from happening?
Well, I think one of the issues, and I'm sure you've seen this, Ben, with, you're in the course of your reporting, because you have a long career of you know, investigative journalism as well. A lot of times in these situations, when there's an investigation, which they do have open right now, or you know, court proceedings currently going on right now involving the two prison guards who are being charged with forging documents, fake timestamps and things like that, when they were supposed to be watching over Epstein. A lot of times that's used as an excuse to say we can't release any information on, you know, a related issue, and in which in this case would be what happened that night to Epstein, what ultimately caused his death. The things that I would be very interested in seeing are the interviews that were conducted with the guards and other prison officials who were there that night, full medical records, including the records from his first alleged suicide attempt, footage, like full footage that they have from the prison. And the thing I would be most interested in seeing, I think, would be interviews with the inmates who are on his cell block at the time of his death. Because what we found during the course of our reporting was that the inmates on that cell block were dispersed and taken elsewhere pretty much immediately after Epstein's body was found. So did any federal authorities talk to them? Did they interview them? Were they able to identify, you know, who these inmates were, and what did they say? What did they see? What did they hear? I think that would be very important to know.
Dan, do you think that we will ever know the truth about what happened that night?
I'm optimistic. Sure, I think we will. Hopefully this book is a start. As I said, we lay out what we know at this point, and we let people draw their own conclusions. But, you know, secrets are hard to keep secret. And people do have a way of talking, and information does have a way of getting out. But I do think it would be helpful if sort of more people were interested, and including, you know, like the Attorney General, mm-hmm. if he was as interested when he made the statements about calling it for an investigation as he is, if he was as interested now as he was then, I think we could get answers. There are people who know, they just need to speak.
Alana, same question to you.
Yeah, I agree with Dan on this. And I also think, you know, this is the month that Epstein's trial was supposed to start. And, you know, it's been 10 months since his death. And I think that the victims in this case deserve to know what happened that night. And I think that people should press for more information from the federal government about this.
The book is A Convenient Death, The Mysterious Demise of Jeffrey Epstein by Alana Goodman and Daniel Halper. You can find it on sale now at Amazon and wherever books are sold. Alana and Daniel, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back with more soon. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. You want to finish what you started?